Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
Did you read the book, Heather?
Damn straight I did. You're damn straight I did.
From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette. I'm Greta Johnson, and you're listening to the Nerdette Book Club. It's just like a normal book club, except you don't have to share the amazing treats you made. I am here with Heather Havrileski, who writes the Ask Polly advice column for New York Magazine. Hey, Heather.
Hi.
Is it true that you read this book in the last, like, 24 hours?
Yes, I did. I started it yesterday afternoon. There's nothing more invigorating than reading a book with a gun pointed at your head.
You missed that deadline feeling, huh? And we are joined by Jill Hopkins, host of The Morning Amp on WBEZ's sister station, Vocalo. She also hosted a little podcast here at WBEZ called Making Beyonce. No big deal, no big deal, no big deal. Hey, Jill.
Hey, white people.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So we're also going to hear from some of you. We got some great listener voicemails that we'll listen to later on. So we are talking about the book Such a Fun Age. This is a debut novel by Kylie Reid. It came out on December 31st. It was super buzzy. New York Times called it provocative yet soapy, which I love. We're about to spoil the shit out of this book. If you're the kind of person who isn't super into reading books and loves spoilers, like my friend Amy, you're welcome. Carry on. If you, like me, are so afraid of spoilers that you don't even read the back of the book before you read the book, go read the book, come back and listen. That's the whole point of the podcast book club. We will still be here for you. Should we get started?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so this book opens with one of the most intense, fascinating chapters I've read in a really long time. We have Mira. She's our main character. She's at her friend's 26th birthday party. And it's after 10 o'clock on a Saturday night, and she gets a call from the mother of the child Amira babysits, whose name is Alix. And Alix is asking her to babysit right then and there. She's like, something happened to our house. We need to call the police because it's been vandalized. It would be really helpful to us if you could get our 2-year-old out of the house and just like take her to the grocery store and hang out with her for a while. Amira is this like, you know, mid-20s babysitter. She's a black girl. She really can't afford to say no, right? Like, this woman, Alix, offers her double time and to pay her cab fare. So she's like, sure, I'll leave this birthday party. I'm going to do it. Like, that's solid math. So she leaves the party with her friend Zara, and they go to the house of Alix to pick up Briar, the little kid, and then they go to the grocery store. And Heather, do you want to jump in here? What happens at the grocery store?
Well, I guess Briar really, and this is maybe one of the best written little girl characters,
right?
I've ever read anywhere. It's almost like every single line must be lifted from some child somewhere.
Yes.
I have 2 daughters, and this was spot on. Like, her entire personality, I loved.
Yeah.
But she likes to look at the nuts in the, you can kind of picture like a Whole Foods-y sort of.
Yeah, like in the bulk section and just like, yep, just these columns of nuts in plastic tubes.
So loitering in this high-end grocery store is not foreign to them at all. They've done this before. And it's immediately this great scene where Amira and Zara are dancing in the frozen food aisle, I believe, because some Whitney Houston song comes on. Which one is it?
I Want to Dance with Somebody.
Yeah. I want to dance with somebody. Yeah.
It is literally physically impossible. This is just science. That you can't not dance when hearing that song.
And even if you're not dancing, you're definitely going to go, I want to feel the heat with somebody.
It's your legal obligation.
I don't know what happens first. Some terrible Karen passes them and is suspicious.
Terrible Karen. Yeah. A rando white lady who looks like she's smiling along with them dancing.
Hey,
the first down, snake appearance in the novel.
And she ends up like going to the grocery store security guard and expressing concern that these two young black women dancing with this small white child in the frozen food section are like up to no good. So from there, things get really tense. The security guard essentially, you know, is accusing Amira of kidnapping Briar. We should mention Zara, the friend, has left at this point. So it's just Amira and Briar. And he tells her she's not dressed like a babysitter, but she had just been at this birthday party, yeah. Right? So,
and like, what did he expect? She was going to pull a lamp out of a carpet bag, take off on her umbrella. Like, yeah, what the hell does a babysitter dress like?
Right, right. And so, meantime, like, it's getting heated enough that this other guy who's at the grocery store starts filming the interaction. Like, he's got his phone out. And he's recording it all. And he's even like interjecting, you know, like when the security guard asks her for ID, he's like, you don't have to do that. Like Philadelphia, Pennsylvania law, like you don't have to do any of this stuff. And she, Amira, is just like trying to diffuse the situation as well as she possibly can. But it's just one of those situations where, I mean, like we've all seen enough, you know, dash cam footage to know that this could go super wrong, right?
Yeah. And I was bracing myself for it, too.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Like it's intense. And you can tell that Amira is trying so desperately to keep her cool, even though she's also like extremely indignant and offended and frustrated that.
Well, once suspicion enters the picture and you can almost feel like the panic set in because it's like, oh, my God, this guy doesn't trust me. He's just going straight to you're some sort of criminal. I'm sure of it, which is insanity. But it's a familiar, you know, acceleration. We've seen it.
But I think that moment points to Amira's. Her strength as a babysitter, as a companion to this little girl, and that she's obviously thinking of Briar before she's thinking of herself and her safety. And if she wasn't equipped to handle the police at home, what makes you think that she'd be equipped to deal with a more immediate police presence in this grocery store?
Yeah.
Poor thing.
I think the other piece that's, I mean, there are a lot of things that are disturbing about it, but the security guard and this other, the woman we've called Karen now, is they both try to talk to Briar. They both like essentially ignore Amira and try to get this little kid to explain what's happening and who Amira is, which is so
unreasonable. Go ahead, tell us you're being kidnapped. Tell us the truth, honey.
You know, and Amira then is just, it feels like she's being completely erased and ignored in this scenario, which I think also makes it just like, just really intense and hard to read.
Yeah. And this was like the first.
This is like what, 10 pages
this is 10
in?
10 pages
in. Oh my God.
And I had already at this point at least twice said to myself, mm-hmm, been there.
Ugh.
And
oh God.
It was so. I couldn't read this book before bed until the first night and the last night that I tried to read it because I had to finish it. This was like setting off all sorts of like anxiety triggers for me. And it was. It was a roller coaster.
I'm sorry to put you through.
Oh, my God.
No, I was going to read it anyway.
So from there, the situation ends up being, I guess, more or less resolved because Amira says she's going to call Briar's dad. She's like, and she literally says, like, he's a white dude. I'm sure everyone will feel much more comfortable when he's here. And so she calls up the dad of Briar, this TV news anchor named Peter Chamberlain, and he like jogs over from his house and like immediately diffuses the situation and takes Briar home. And
it was the healing power of whiteness.
The healing power of whiteness.
When y'all figure out how to bottle it,
it's expensive.
That's how you get rich.
Yeah, it's super pricey. Organic whiteness is so costly.
So Amira is leaving the grocery store and this dude who is filming the interaction is like, yo, you should have this video. And she wants nothing to do with it. She's like, no, like, I'm not gonna, like, whatever you think I'm about to do in terms of lawsuits or anything, that is not what I want to do. Please don't let me have anything to do with this. And he says, how about this? I'll email it to you and then I'll delete it off my phone and you can do whatever you want with it from there. But like, you should at least have it. And so she gives him her email address and he emails it to her. And then she calls up her friend Zara and they meet up. And she like tries to play it cool for a really long time. And then at the end of the chapter, this is actually the moment that you tweeted about yesterday, Heather.
Yeah.
She just like breaks down.
We should read the actual thing.
Yeah,
let's read it. Here, I have it.
Okay.
Girl, Zara says, that could have been bad. Amira laughed and said, Z, it's fine. But then she put the back. Oh my God, I'm gonna cry. Mm. But then she put the back of her hand.
Oh, sweetie.
There's something about this. It's like, it's ironic, but there's something about trying to be tough and restrain your emotion is like it just fucking breaks me. Okay. She put the back of her hand to her mouth and silently started to cry.
The fact that it's still restrained tears even at that point, right? Where she's letting herself fall apart, but she's still holding herself together as much as she possibly can, is just like,
really?
Yeah. So that's page 19.
And that's such a good, I mean, the first chapter, first of all, the clip that it moves at is so fast. It's so quick.
Yeah.
And you're just you're rushing along in this roller coaster ride, like, oh, Jesus, no, no, no. And I think is a brilliant, because it's exactly like being in one of those, how it must feel to be in an insane situation where you're panicking. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like there's nothing you can say to change it.
Well, and I think it shows so much about her character, too, because she's obviously, as you mentioned, Jill, like super concerned about the well-being of this kid. And she's extremely responsible, you know, like there's this line before she even leaves the birthday party where she like checks for her wallet and her phone. Like she is like on top of everything. And, you know, and she even discloses to the mother when she calls, she's like, just so you know, like I'm not dressed like a babysitter. I've had a couple drinks, you know, like she does everything right. And yet the situation still happens.
This is the first in this book that I think we take a look at the double-edged sword of being a strong Black woman, or the perception of being a strong Black woman, whether it be from other people or of yourself, especially if you are charged with the care of somebody else who is defenseless. Then you find yourself having to be this strong thing for that person and then not wanting to drop that guard even when you're with your closest friend, because we're expected to, and you kind of internalize that expectation that society puts on you, and you expect yourself to, and it's exhausting, to be totally frank. It's very tiring. I can only imagine the kind of sleep that Amira got that night. Heavy but fretful is what I would project onto that, and it is, you know, something that she's clearly had to deal with her whole life and continues to deal with through her interactions with lots of the other characters. It was really something. It was really something.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, too, how throughout the rest of the book, you know, a number of different white people keep telling her how sorry they are that the thing happened at the grocery store, or like, you know, they all lose their minds about it and are like, oh, my God, are you OK? This is so intense. You know, the lawsuit, blah, blah, blah. And every time she's so consistent about never communicating to anyone how impactful and stressful that moment was for her.
Well, then she takes on the stress of just thinking about what would happen if this video gets out.
Right.
And,
right.
Yeah. And that's something that we have seen in real life all the time.
Yeah.
When, you know, somebody gets caught with their hand in the racist cookie jar, and then the person on the other side of that is now the inadvertent target of the internet's criticism. Like the person who calls 911 at the people barbecuing in the park, that was their choice to call 911. The people barbecuing in the park were just barbecuing in the park. They're minding their own business.
Right. It's Karen who thinks they're booty dancing in the frozen foods aisle.
So why bring all this internet attention to yourself if you don't have to? And then you weigh it against, I don't have any money. This could be my ticket out of this crappy lifestyle. And even when you weigh that against the ire of racists on the internet, it still didn't seem worth it to
them. Well, because even then it's like, I don't have any money, sure. But then also, like, how am I going to, like, what are people going to think of me when I'm applying for jobs because this thing happened, right? Like, there are just so many other repercussions around all of it.
I just think having to represent and be the face of anything just sucks.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, not that many people are built to take on that kind of a role. It's a hard role to just walk around and then everyone sees you as, it's like being Florence the Progressive Lady. You know, like now that's what you are everywhere you go, and you gotta hold forth with sound bites on this cause that you didn't necessarily want to begin with. I mean, it's rough.
Yeah.
And part of it, right, is that like Amira is 25. She's babysitting. She's also like transcribing stuff for the Green Party a couple days a week. She has not figured out, she's a college graduate who does not know what her next steps are. And when she turns 26, she will lose her health insurance because she's on her parents' health insurance. So it is just like a very significant time in her life in terms of like, what the fuck am I doing and how do I like figure out how to get my shit together?
What were you doing with yourself when you were 25?
Yeah, right.
Getting drunk a lot.
Oh, so much.
Yeah. I want that guy with the fade. He sounded really good. But I just wanted to say, Amira is also the only character in the entire book who's not, I mean, okay, this might not be completely accurate, but out of most of the characters, she's not an opportunist at all. And yeah, in some ways, she's the most present character in the book also. She's able to connect with Briar at a really kind of not basic, but a deep kind of experiential level.
Pure.
Yeah, a pure, sweet, amazing level. And in some ways, her lack of, I don't want to say lack of ambition, but an ability to not think about the future all the time, which is a quality, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
she's living her life in the moment in kind of a very clear way that a lot of the other characters aren't.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, too, it's important to note that she was the first one in her family to go to college, which also means that, like, she doesn't have a lot of templates in her life, probably, for what she is supposed to be doing. So she just, it kind of seems like she's unmoored. She's sort of at a loss, but she knows that she's really good at taking care of this little girl, and she really loves this kid.
She, of all of her friends, seems to be enjoying the luxury of youth the least.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The rest of them are like, you know, four 25, 26-year-olds, they have their acts together. And, you know, this is one of the times in the book I was like, you know what, just at me next time. Like, why do you have to call out my life? Or she's got this, like, loud existential ticking going on in her mind that doesn't exist in the minds of the other young characters here. And so she's not fully able to go out on five-day trips to wherever. She can't go to the expensive place for dinner. She's, you know, kind of scrambling, and it's taking its toll on her well-being. And God bless those friends of hers for still getting it and still hanging out. Because when you're like that age, your friends that you thought you had forever, they start to fall away. And it's really hard for you to understand and accept while it's happening.
Yeah. I love those scenes with her friends.
Yes.
Let me just say.
They're so
so well written and so vivid and so amazing. Like, I was just like, I wish these were my friends so bad. I love how they mock each other.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yep.
I want friends that mock each other openly more, actually.
You don't want that.
Yeah, I do.
My friends
That's what I love.
When I moved out of Chicago when I was like 23 years old, I tried to live in New York for a minute. My friends threw me like a Friars Club roast. I sat on a stage for 2 hours.
Luxury. Luxury.
These people just called me sluts and whores.
Oh, yeah.
And drunks and bitches.
This is my, Jill, this is my dream, and you're making me angry now. That's my dream.
All right. Well, in that case, let's move on. We don't want Heather to get angry.
When's your birthday, Heather?
June 2nd.
Coming up.
Ding, ding.
Let's talk a little bit about Alix's background as an influencer, because that's actually the chapter that comes right after this, like, very explosive, intense scene, is we learn about the mother who, it turns out, what, ever since college, like, would do this really cute thing where she would just ask companies to give her stuff and they would do it because she would post about it on social media or whatever, which I think is just, like, such a great example of just like the audacity and privilege that she grows up with, that like that's the world she lives in, where she's just like, oh yeah, I just ask them for stuff and they give it to me. It's just like such exquisite entitlement.
This book at this point to me could have just been titled This Bitch. I was over Alix from the jump. I want Alix to have gotten scammed from the Fyre Festival. I want bad things to happen to her.
So yeah, in turn, she ends up starting this cute company that's based on like letter writing called Let Her Speak. And it's like, I don't know, she tries to get connected with the Hillary campaign at one point, but it's the way Kylie Reid describes it, you don't get a lot of, there's not a lot of context or like depth to what this thing is, right? Like,
okay, I want to say though, as an intensely mediocre Karen myself.
Listen, you're a Becky. Don't sell yourself short. Aim higher.
Let's just say sometimes Becky's worry about being Karens and have Karen-like tendencies, and it's embarrassing.
I can relate to that, yes.
Like they have Karen shame. This kicked up so much of my Karen shame that I can't even handle it. Although she's pretty obviously an unlikable human, what I loved about how this book was written is that her reasons for wanting these kind of vain and strange, shallow sort of distractions are very kind of clear. Like, she feels like she's becoming irrelevant, which is that is a true and real central feeling to being a Becky or a Karen, honestly.
Sure.
Or any woman at that age, really. That's a really universal truth.
Well, and part of that, too, is, like, she had lived in New York, and they've just moved to Philadelphia. Like, she had, once she gave birth to her second daughter in New York, they were like, let's do it. Let's move to Philly. Let's like get the house. But she's still posting on Instagram pretending like she lives in New York. Like she just can't let it go.
Poser.
Which I think is another great example of what you're talking about, Heather, right? Where it's just like she wants so desperately to be a part of this scene that she just like inherently isn't anymore.
And also all of her friends, which I mean, we're not quite there yet, but
we're
the friends are an echo of her values. And the friends are all about, girl, just you got to lose that weight.
Yes.
The weight and you just get back in there and get that money. And don't worry, we'll save you from irrelevance. And then in contrast, I mean, and this is real, like she has this birthday party for her daughter.
Yeah. So that's actually the next scene, yeah, is Alique's, I mean, she's mortified that this thing happened at the grocery store, right? Like, she just thinks it's the worst thing. She has no idea how to talk to Amira, her babysitter, about it. So she calls all of her best friends, who all still live in New York. They're like three ladies, and they have this like group call about it. And she's like, what do I do? Can I talk to her about this? And they're all like, oh my God, absolutely. You need to become her best friend, essentially, is the advice they give her.
This was, okay, so this scene was a little bit of a carnival of horror Karens, okay? And I did have a little tiny tick of like, this is kind of like Sex in the City, but super warped and a little bit like, almost a little bit too fantastically harsh to these women, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're all horrified when she says she's gained weight. They're like, no, that's not you.
Well, and the weight gain, for the record, is 8 pounds from pre-baby, just to be clear.
Oh, my God. I've gained 8 pounds since I've sat here talking to you.
Right?
And
since
I'm
finishing
the opposite of pregnant.
So, yeah, it turns out the next day is the day of Briar's third birthday. Briar being the kid who Amira is the babysitter of. So Alique's calls Amira first thing that morning just to make sure Amira is okay and that she still wants to come to the birthday party. And it's like just early enough of a phone call that Amira is like exhausted and disoriented. And I think it's just another fascinating example of like the consistency to which Alique's thinks she is doing the right thing and like going out of her way to be helpful, but really just keeps violating boundaries that she should be able to see as the person, like the powerful person in the dynamic, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and also I love how the author plays up her neurotic tics and how she, I mean, just not only the repeated apologies, but also just like, you okay? Everything good? Like hovering around. Like, I saw myself so much in that. I was just the shame. I mean, there's so much shame in this book for me. It's terrible. It hurts.
That's interesting because I feel like this book, like one thing I really love about this book is that I thought it invited me as a white lady to reflect on my own like bias and racism, but it like without being super shamey.
That's because you're cooler than I am. Flat, full stop. Right? I mean, I have two girls, and I moved to the suburbs of L.A. out of a cool neighborhood.
Man, so I just made both of you read this book that was, like, extremely triggering for each of
terrible.
You.
Terrible.
Huh?
No, I mean, this was a good way to start the year with self-reflection and guilt and
self-hatred.
Shame.
And falling down a huge well into the darkness.
Very kind of both of you to say. Okay,
it's cathartic.
It was.
So when payday comes, Alique's gives Amira a bunch of money. And she buys herself this awesome leather jacket because she's like, why not? And that is the moment when she runs into Kelly on the train, who is the dude who recorded the video at the grocery store. And he asks her out. And they end up meeting up at the club later that night.
Can I just interject that when he puts his palm, the palms of his hands on the top of the subway?
Uh-huh.
And she's like, that's really a show-off move, but it's highly attractive. Mm-hmm.
But it works.
Yeah,
you could totally picture that.
Yeah. He's like a
right
super
there.
Tall guy.
I was like curling my toes.
Hey,
can for the sake of transparency, full disclosure here, I'm also married to a very tall white man.
Ooh.
But unlike Kelly, he is not his group of friends, down ass white boy. Every group of black men has one white guy that is invited to things. And Aaron has been that, but not for the reasons, like, he's just handy. He's nice to be around. He doesn't, like, listen to a bunch of, like, very underground hip hop. Actually, no, that's not true. He does, but it's not something that endears him to the black community.
So, to put a little more context to this, Amira essentially is like, I'm meeting up with friends. I'm going to be at this bar. If you want to come buy me a drink, you can totally do that. But she doesn't think he's going to show up.
Yeah.
And then when he does, it's like with a bunch of black dudes at this club. And there's this amazing line. Kelly looked like he was getting filmed for the intro of an extremely problematic music video.
It's so good. There's so many good lines.
Drake song playing
in
the back.
Hilarious. So from there, they go back to his place. It's super hot. It becomes clear that like he is definitely like more grown up than she is in terms of like he's got a consistent job. He has a pretty nice apartment. His furniture looks good. Like he's 7 years older than her. So he's in his early 30s. And then the end of that chapter is where we find out that Kelly, this dude, ruined Alix's senior year. But that's all we know about that so far.
Yeah. And that's one of those things where you kind of realize, because you find that out, because you find out that he's from Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Right.
He's
yes.
got a map of his hometown on the wall. And Amira's like, huh, Allentown.
Yeah.
She's who like, do I know from
that?
Allentown?
Yes.
Which tells you that she and her employer haven't even had like the smallest bit of small talk, because that's like getting to know you 101.
Yeah. Yeah.
And and she never found that out about Alix. So what else doesn't she know? What else don't they know about each other? And that comes into play in the whole rest of the book.
We find out, I can't remember exactly where, I think it's a little later on, we find out that her name is actually Alix, but there came a point where she decided to become Alix, A-L-I-X, and to pronounce it weird, which even that is just like insufferable.
Just kill me now.
So, imagine this woman freshman year of college after one philosophy class.
Like, oh my God.
Imagine her.
Actually,
I can picture, I think I've met her actually.
So that's the end of part one. The opening of part two is when we find out that Alix, in her efforts to like become BFFs with Amira, is reading her phone because Amira leaves her cell phone like charging by the front door so Alix can read it on her way in. Which is like, okay, great. That's horrible.
That's terrible.
And Alix is like getting home earlier and earlier so that she can like make Amira kind of hang out with her while they're on the clock. And then from there, we get the flashback of Alix telling the most embarrassing moment of her life to her girlfriends back in the day. Which, Jill, you want to take this one?
Okay. So what had happened was
this is hard.
The gals are sitting around jibber jabbing about times gone by, as you do.
So they're sharing their most embarrassing moments.
Yeah, and honestly, none of these things are that embarrassing. Or maybe I've just had a very embarrassing life and it didn't register to me. Same with Alix's problem. Yeah, it was embarrassing, but I as she told her story, she's a senior in high school. She's dating Kelly, who is a year younger than she is, and she is, even in high school, the kind of person that's writing flowery letters to the people in her life. So she's leaving these letters in his locker, talking about, come to my mansion. We have a
paper
pool.
Sexed.
Yes, it was a paper sext.
It wasn't.
Did you send a paper
sext?
So she's like, I got a jacuzzi. I got a pool. My parents are going to be out of town. Here's the code to the gate.
Yeah.
But the most popular kid in school,
Robbie.
Robbie?
Yeah.
he gets a hold of like the gate combination, and mm-hmm. he and his friends are just like, we're going to crash this party. We're going to hang out in the pool. And Alix says to Kelly that you showed him the letter, and Kelly is insistent that he had not. And Alix is like, well, how else would he know the code?
Yeah, and yeah, we were it's here. Like a complete violation of her privacy yeah. and respect.
This is right after she loses her virginity
yep.
to him.
Yes. Yes. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So she calls the cops on this dude
on Robbie
and his friends.
And his friends.
Who are all black.
Yes. And the cops come. Robbie loses his scholarship.
Yeah,
as it turns
he gets
out, he's
in
an
some
athlete.
Real trouble. Yeah,
yeah, and it kind of, you know, sets him up on a path. It sets Alix's social status on a path for the remainder of the year, and then Kelly breaks up with her shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
You know, I laughed. I don't know. I probably would have been heartbroken too. But he says to her, and I'm paraphrasing here. I think that we should go on separate paths.
Go our separate ways.
And I hope those paths never
meet again.
Never meet again.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, damn, homie.
Yeah.
So yeah. She's devastated.
The old-fashioned ghosting.
Yeah. And she's leaving this school and this life behind. And that's probably when she decides, you know, when I get to college, I'm going to be a whole new person. Nobody's going to hurt me like this again.
Well, and she even talks about how like she decides to go to a school out of state, even though that means more tuition. And then she has to take out student loans because her parents won't pay for it. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, it's this whole thing. It's like a moment that defines the rest of her trajectory to a certain extent. I mean, like, that's partly why she decides to become a Alix, too.
It's a kind of like a grasp for control. You can see her kind of white lady control freak origin story.
Yeah, totally. And then you find out that because Kelly goes on to kind of give his version of these events to Amira while they're dating. But, you know, she doesn't realize, and Kelly certainly doesn't know, that the same woman is Amira's boss.
Right, right. So, yeah, like, all of these pieces are slowly coming into place, and that's actually the end of part two, so I think we should just take a quick break here, and then we'll resume in just a moment.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
So we also got some fun listener comments about Such a Fun Age. Jordan on Instagram said, some books take you 3 months to read and some take you 3 days. Damn, this one was good. It took Heather even less time than that.
A single day.
And Lindsay on Goodreads said, I started the book in the morning and just finished at 1 a.m. I couldn't put it down. So with that said, I think like one of the most tense moments beyond, of course, that opening chapter is the opening of part three, which is the Thanksgiving dinner. So there's this horrible snowstorm in Philadelphia, which means both Amira and Kelly happen to not be able to fly home for Thanksgiving. And Alix, not knowing who Amira's boyfriend is and desperately wanting to become friends with Amira, invites them over for Thanksgiving dinner. And she has also invited her three best New York lady friends. So this is just like the perfect recipe for like an extremely amazing and awkward meal.
And let it be said that at this point, Alix is obsessed with Amira.
Obsessed.
Oh, yeah.
Totally obsessed.
So.
Yeah.
Inappropriately. Sees her as a possession. She refers to her as my sitter over and over again.
Yeah.
Every time I saw those words, I cringed.
Yeah. It reminds me of an email we got actually from Amy who said, I felt like Alix's strange obsession with Amira was a mix of attempting to ignore her white privilege and racism, maybe even trying to atone for it, but also trying to befriend her or even own her in a way some people enjoy owning exotic animals.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
It's and also adopt true. Her while she ignores
yes.
her actual kid.
When Alix's friends were like, Alix, you are the best thing that ever happened to this girl.
Yeah.
You're saving her life. Thank God weed is legal in the state of Illinois because Honestly, I could not have gotten through that whole thing sober. I was so upset with them.
But yeah, I mean, there is like this really intense, like fucked up scene before the Thanksgiving dinner starts where Tamara, who is Alix's black friend, asks Amira to like help her roll napkin, silverware or something into a napkin.
And Tamara, like a really obvious.
Yeah. Like, oh, like come chat with me. I'm going to take you under my wing now as like two of the only black people at this party. And Tamara like interrogates her about her hair, which was really horrible.
It was really horrible, but it was a really great way to differentiate the kinds of black folks in this book.
Yeah, yeah.
We are not a monolith. We contain multitudes, blah, blah, blah.
Thank you, Jill.
But I mean, each one of Amira's friends are different from each other in that one generation of people, but all four of them are so much different than Tamara is. It's partially her age. It's partially like that she's like a principal of a school and is like kind of used to being an authoritarian. But there's also that kind of pull up your pants, young buck mentality.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how old you are as a black person. Let me tell you that you find a younger black person and you want to boss them around. There's something in our DNA that is telling us to do that. But when you bring hair into it, that brings a certain class discussion into it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like she's just coming in and being like, oh, I know how to fix you. Here's what we do.
Yeah.
You know?
And a black woman's hair, I mean, hair in general is very personal. It's your crown. It's your self-expression. And for her to go directly at the way that she chooses to present herself in front of company was very, you know, maternal, but not in a good way.
So, yeah, this is the point where you know that Alix is spinning out because here she is. She thought this Thanksgiving dinner would be like the moment to get Amira to finally love her and she'd get to meet Amira's cute little boyfriend. Turns out Amira's boyfriend is her ex, this dude who ruined her senior year of college. So now So now, like as if she cared about what other people thought of her before, now it's like to the max where she is just like she stays up all that night after the dinner, like Googling Kelly and figuring out what he's been up to. And it's just like, I just think it's a great scene. And then it culminates with Briar, the 3-year-old, just puking everywhere.
Classic Briar.
And Amira being the only one who notices that Briar is sick. Because Alix is like so in her own head
melting
about all of it.
Melting down.
Okay, can I just interject one? This is my only complaint with the entire book.
Yeah.
Can I interject it here or should I wait?
No, if now is the time, Heather, do it.
Okay, I want Amira and Briar to be together forever, just to be clear.
Yeah.
I'd prefer if Amira just ran out the door, grabbed Briar and ran
like
out the
actually
door.
Kidnapped the child?
Yes, that would kidnap so that well child and give her a better life. Uh-huh. She needs to be taken away from all of this.
Yeah.
But the only complaint I have as a mother about the character of Amira is that in every single scene, she is the perfect nurturing caretaker of a 3-year-old. And in every single scene, that 3-year-old is magically
charming and
gloriously charming and lovable,
adorable and
like
quirky,
the kid in Jerry Maguire. Okay.
A human brain weighs 15 pounds.
It's so easy to fall in love with even Tom Cruise when, or even, you know, Renee Zellweger, whichever way you want to see it, when there's the perfect little delightful mascot soundtrack, might as well be Babu Freak or, you know, R2-D2 standing next to you going, I am adorable. But then on top of that, Amira is 25 years old, 26 years old.
About to
at
be
this
26,
point.
Yeah.
She's around this 3-year-old. Her nerves never fray, not once. I mean, that's a little bit magical, right?
Yeah. You think it's too magical?
I think it's an archetype, actually, right? Like, it's like she's a magical, wonderful.
She's Mary Poppins.
Yeah. And I think that is a flaw. It's a flaw because all you need is one scene where her nerves are a little frayed and she's like, okay, can you please just simmer the fuck down?
I think that speaks to the author's like respect for the profession of childcare, where in no way was the child care provider ever the bad guy. Like this it's like being a nurse or a firefighter. Like this is a very important job. It's a job that most women have had in their lives, and I want to pay it the respect that I think it's due.
Okay, so after awkward Thanksgiving that culminates in a child vomiting, Kelly and Amira go back to Kelly's place, except that he decides right before he gets to the apartment that he actually wants to go to his favorite dive bar down the road. So he has the cab drop them off there instead. And it's like immediately evident to Amira that this is a very like white dude drinking space. Mm-hmm. And he immediately at her is like, you have to quit your job. Alix is a bad person. Like, I never told you the backstory of this, but like she did this super weird racist thing back in high school where she called the cops on a couple friends. And like, you need to quit. This is, you can't do this. You have to quit your job. You have to quit your job. And he gets to the point where he's like yelling at her. He's like slamming his hand on the table. Mm-hmm. She feels extremely uncomfortable. And she's kind of like, who are you to tell me that I have to quit my job?
I've known you for like 3 weeks or 3 months or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't know my life.
It's also a great space for his particular control freak fantasy to play out because this white dive bar is like where he feels at home, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are very few scenes where anyone asks Amira how she feels.
Zara and Briar are really the only.
That's right.
So she still does end up going back to his place that night, but she does. After that, it's like one of the only scenes where she really says her piece, I think, to him. And she kind of lays out, I forget, maybe it's three things. And, you know, the first one is like, you can't just take me to bars like this.
Yeah.
And the other one is like, you can't keep mentioning this fucking grocery store video. Like, I don't want to do anything about it. You need to respect that. And I forget what the third one is, but it was a great scene because it is one of the only times where you really see Amira standing up for herself against someone who thinks they have her best interest in mind, right? Mm-hmm.
And once again, Amira thinking long term, she gave herself the time and space to really think about what she wanted to say. She didn't respond off the cuff and say something that she might go on to regret as opposed to literally everyone else that
evening.
She
doesn't lose her shit. She doesn't hit anything or yell. Yeah.
I kind of love, I want to be more like Amira in my everyday life.
Oh God, me too. She has so much restraint. Even just that scene where she meets Kelly and he's flirting with her and she's like, not quite good enough. I'm like, God damn it,
I know. Boys love that shit, though.
I know. Jesus. I'm like, hey, oh, do you need my number? Do you need my cell phone? Wait, hold on. I'll find it. He just said I was his girlfriend. I'm his girlfriend. Yeah, me. Here. Should I not get off? Should I just go to your stop?
Way to lock it down, Heather.
I'm so.
Two kids later, it clearly worked.
I know how to seal that deal. Yes, sir. I'm so mysterious. Wow.
So from there, we find out Alix is she has completely lost it. She's spending way too much time, stalking these people on Facebook, looking as much stuff up as possible. She decides to spend a couple days in New York with the younger baby to revitalize her New York life, to strive to become more relevant.
And she's supposed to be doing work things, but all she does is eat ice cream at her favorite spot and take pictures.
Exactly.
Like a 13-year-old.
Yep. And then from there, the plan is for her to come back from New York and to tell Amira that Kelly is a bad person. She essentially wants to do the same exact thing Kelly did, where she's like, Kelly's racist. He fetishizes black women. He's only ever dated black women. I can tell this because I've been stalking him on Facebook for the last week. You need to break up with him. Which is fascinating and frustrating and kind of perfect, right?
Yeah. These two people who desperately want Amira in their lives are doing the most to push her away. And I feel like these grown-up adults should have thought of that part of it.
The
part of Amira that makes her a person you want to be around is that she is smart and funny and able to make her own decisions and live her life. And they're trying to strip that one thing that she has, I think, or that she might think she has, her autonomy.
Yeah.
Away from her.
I think it's also a great example of the fact that both of these white people have decided the other white person is extremely racist.
You guys aren't a monolith either. You can contain multitudes.
Nuances of racism.
Really?
So from there, Alix comes back from New York and essentially tells Kelly that he's a bad dude. Amira's kind of like, yeah, no, I don't think so. I feel like I know this guy pretty well. He's not fetishizing me. I'm going to go to this movie with your daughter like we had planned. And then Alix, in like
2 seconds,
one of the most astounding things, decides to go to Kelly's workplace and confront him about his racist ass.
And how might Alix know where Kelly works? Good question. It's because she's been reading Amira's text messages mm-hmm. for like the past 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I hate her so much.
That interaction, too, is so amazing because Kelly, you know, I mean, who's obviously flawed in his own way, too. Like, he calls bullshit on a lot of the things that Alix is saying, to the point where, you know, she's like, Amira's like family to me. And he's like, oh, that's cute, because, you know, today is her birthday, right? And yeah. You have her working. And Alix had no fucking clue, because she doesn't actually care about Amira at all, essentially, right? Yeah.
Once again, getting to know you 101 out the window, straight to obsessive stalking.
Yep. And then she goes home and manages to open up the computer, realizes Amira's email is still open from checking movie times before, finds the fucking grocery store video that Kelly had emailed to her, and sends it to the fucking local TV station.
Yeah. Calls her husband's coworker and is like, oh, who she doesn't even like, by the way. She calls this woman who's been desperately trying to get her to be her friend, and she's like, let me take advantage of this relationship and send it to the... I also like the part very much where this is the part where, in case you weren't sure that Alix was a piece of shit, that she comes home and is like, oh my God, I left the one kid I like here by herself.
The one kid
she
I like.
She forgot about the baby.
The baby.
She left the baby at home when she went to confront Kelly.
She stalked this guy at his place of work, got home, and only realized that she had forgotten her child at home when she started fussing on the baby monitor.
And then she's like, imagine how bad it would have looked if something had happened.
Yeah. Not imagine how bad, my child would be in pain if something had happened. Like, oh my God, what if Instagram found out? And then, despite this moment that should have told her on herself, she still sends that video.
Yeah, she still, that, because that could have been the moment where, like, major character development, she's like, oh my God, I just left my baby unattended to this person.
She's
who...
not a learner. She's not a learner.
Yeah,
she doesn't like learning.
Yeah, because that could have been it.
She basically, it's kind of like a parable about someone who wants to just does things to fix them, control them.
That's a really interesting point.
And never takes in the information around them. Like, she's looking for clues and hints that back up her hypothesis.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, but
she's
not
never looking
to rewrite the hypothesis. Yeah. So as we have learned, it's Amira's birthday. She goes to a party that night. All of her friends are there. Kelly shows up.
Oh, yeah. It's
all
Amira's
of a sudden, one of her friends, it's her 26th birthday, which is like fun, but also ominous, right? Because she's about to lose health insurance. And this is like a very real deadline for her. So all of a sudden, her friends are like, girl, we got to go in the bathroom. Like, I have something you need to see. They go in there. Turns out the video has like gone viral online because fucking Alix sent it out. But Amira doesn't know that it's Alix who did it, right? Mm-hmm. She assumes it's Kelly because Kelly was the only one who had the video. So she comes out, confronts him, accuses him of doing this. All of her friends back her up, and she leaves and essentially just like hides out in her house for the rest of the weekend because she's mortified that this video is out in the world and it wasn't on her terms. And she thinks the guy that she really trusted sent it out.
Yeah.
And that's when Alix decides to go over to Amira's house, which she's never done before, and offer her...
It's so scary.
Yes, it is really scary.
And she brings the children. She brings the children. It's nighttime.
Yeah.
It's like 11 at night.
And she decides to offer Amira a full-time job with benefits and all of it. She's like, she essentially thinks that now that this video's out, she gets to salvage everything. They're starting from scratch. Obviously, she thinks that it was Kelly who submitted it. So that means that she'll break up with Kelly and she wins. She gets to keep Amira. And Amira accepts the full-time job because she doesn't know any better.
Yeah.
And they decide to do a segment on the local TV station to discuss the video now that it's out in the world, which is another amazing scene.
It's such a good scene.
Oh, my God, isn't it?
How many life-changing conversations have happened in your lives in a ladies' room or in a bathroom?
Like with one of you sitting on the toilet?
Yeah. Or texting on top of a sink or something like that. I mean, that's real life, especially for young girls. The conversation in the club happened in the bathroom.
Yeah, that's true. When she comes back from the grocery store. Yeah. Yeah. So what happens is they all meet up at Alix's house. They're going to do like a live hit from Alix's place with Alix and the kids and Amira talking about this video, that the grocery store video. And so Amira goes over there. She brings Zara, and Zara overhears Alix asking the news anchor if she did the right thing by sending her the video. And that's when Zara's like, oh, shit, Kelly didn't actually send this video at all. It was Alix. And so she goes to find Amira, who's getting ready in the bathroom, and is like, hey, we need to get the fuck out of here.
Mm-hmm. You can't take this job.
You cannot take this job. Mm-hmm. And they're in the bathroom, and it's just such a great scene because Zara essentially coaches her into finding another job that exact moment. She's like, nope, call the other people you're temping with. See if they can offer you a full-time job. We're going to negotiate a decent hourly rate while we're in the bathroom. Yeah. We're going to kill time telling them that makeup is just taking longer and I need my comb for my edges. And we're going to like make this happen right now so that you have a job when you walk out and tell Alix to go fuck herself on camera.
So she gets this job. It's the job that she had before, the transcribing
job. Yeah, with
job.
The Green Party. Yeah, it's like an assistant there.
Yeah. And so the viral video brought her to the forefront of that like employment pile with the Green Party. Mm-hmm. I loved that. That like 2-minute negotiation that was probably just like loudly whispered.
Well, and like Zara's got her calculator out. She's like calculating hourly rates. Yeah. And she's like, what about dental? Like they're doing
ask them about dental.
Which is such a beautiful moment too of just like adulting and what it takes to make it happen and how amazing it is that she has this friend who's been with her this whole time.
Everyone needs a friend like
who's
that.
Who's like, okay, $14 an hour is fine as long as there's health insurance. You
it's
know?
Also a really nice contrast because what they're planning, like the wildness that happens after that, it's like the forward-facing aspects of how they seem from the outside and how they actually are and how smart they are and how like meticulous they are about their lives and how responsible.
Yeah.
It's just a really interesting contrast in a study in contrast.
It is really cool.
Whereas Alix seems very detail oriented, but is screwing everything up and is actually completely disorganized,
totally
left their baby in the crib and, you know. But she seems so together and her look at her flower arrangements. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's a really great point.
There's a really good contrast here between the two sides of friend Zara, right? Like, in one moment, she's like doing math and like coaching her friend as like her life mentor.
Yeah.
And then.
But she's also calling Kelly like L.L. Bean dick.
Yeah.
Like,
and Amira knows that those two sides exist in that same friend. So she tells her, listen, we're still going to do this interview.
Yeah.
We're still doing it.
Yeah.
But when I give you the signal, fuck shit up.
You need to wild out.
And her friend, without hesitation, is like, bet.
I got you.
Yeah, I got this.
It's so amazing. So
I squealed when I read this. I was like, oh, yes.
Do it.
So, she still does the interview, and it seems like everything is fine. But then it gets to the point where the TV news anchor asks Amira, she's like, so you're gonna be working full time for Alix, right? And Amira's like, actually, no, I got this other job. And Alix is like completely confused. She like she cannot compute. And then Amira says, who wants to say it?
She gets her so good. She gives her she drops the Kelly line on her. I think we need to go our separate ways and that our paths should never cross again. And then she walks off and then Zara jumps on camera. And she's like, Cash Money Records represented from 99-2000 or whatever it is that she says. Drops the N-bomb on network
singing,
television.
We shall overcome,
she's got like her fist in the air. Oh my God. I loved it so much.
So good.
It was cathartic, wasn't it? It feels cathartic even talking about it right now. Like it was just exquisite.
So good.
Yeah.
And like,
satisfying.
There's, you remember that Simpsons episode where Lisa breaks Ralph's heart and they go back on the videotape and like you can see the exact moment where his heart shattered and frame by frame just his face. I want that of Alix's face as like her entire world.
So this is a great moment to say that before this book was even published, Lena Waithe had already optioned the book.
Yeah.
So we will get to see that moment on a screen.
Oh, it's so optionable, this book.
Oh my
single second I was like, is this a screenplay? Like, come on.
Yeah, no, all the dialogue.
It's written for
like,
the screen.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it's perfect. So, I mean, that's really the climax of the story. From then, we get like a little bit of kind of what happens next. At least we don't hear any more about what happens with Alix. We know Amira gets a sweet job as an admin assistant that she feels really good about.
With her.
We see she runs into Kelly a couple years later, and he's dating a light-skinned black girl, right?
Who sells soaps at the farmer's market.
So much in that one little image.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then there's this last paragraph that I want to spend a little while talking to you guys about, because I don't know if y'all remembered it, but it completely...
I read it like 5 minutes ago, so yeah.
it is searing. I like laughed out loud in a, like a, oh my God, she did this way. It says, deep into her 30s, Amira would wrestle with what to take from her time at the Chamberlain house. Some days she carried the sweet relief that Briar would learn to be a self-sufficient person. And some days Amira would carry the dread that if Briar ever struggled to find herself, she'd probably just hire someone to do it for her.
Oh, damn.
Right?
Yeah. Poor Briar.
That's also a callback to a line earlier in the novel.
Oh,
is it? It's one of my favorite scenes. Yeah, they're at the aquarium. Amira and Briar are at the aquarium, and the lights go out. And Briar says, Amira, I can't find me.
Oh, that's so true.
And I, like, circled it 15,000 times, and I'm like... theme of the whole book.
Wow.
Like, these people are all struggling to find themselves.
And they're all running to Amira to figure it out for
so
them.
Oh, so sad. I just cried for like 5 minutes when I read that.
Ooh,
so
let's not forget about the part where we flash back to high school.
Right. I skipped that. Yes, that is
lets
very
you know
important.
That in case you were struggling to understand whether or not Alix comes from a place of good, she 100% does not. So after the pool party where she called the cops on the black dudes and she has to go back and, I don't know, do like
she's
2 weeks of school as a social pariah, she's like tasked to clean out lockers on the last day of school. And she starts at the letter Z. Because she doesn't want to get to Kelly's locker too soon. He is a C last name.
Yeah.
So she starts at Z and she goes back towards the A elevators and she finally gets to Kelly's lockers. It's one of those locker situations where they aren't full height lockers. Like there's one row on the top and one row on the bottom.
Yeah.
So she's like lovingly, but also like resentfully cleaning out Kelly's locker. She's like, the locker I dropped so many letters into. Now, mind you, this whole time, Kelly's been insistent that he never showed this letter with all the secrets to his friend, whose last name also begins with a C, if we'll remember. So as she's cleaning out these lockers, she gets to Robbie's locker, which is directly underneath Kelly's locker. She's cleaning it out. And she feels something.
And there's like a bunch of notes that she had written wedged in there because they fall from Kelly's locker to the other dude's locker.
So she opens them up and finds out that Kelly, in fact, had never gotten the letter with the key codes and all that stuff. Robbie found out all that stuff on his own. And instead of just like going to Kelly and apologizing or working on herself, she decides.
Yeah, she like actively decides. Yeah.
It's cleaner if I forget that I ever found these.
To pretend like Kelly was just an asshole.
She said she's already made up her mind on what narrative she wants to present to the world. And that if she deviated from it at all, it would really not do her any good. So what difference does it make?
Yeah.
If this kid's scholarship gets revoked, what difference does it make if this boy that she says ruined her senior year is actually not at fault at all? She's going to college. She doesn't need any of this.
And she's going to be a Leaks now. That's the same point.
It's control.
So, yeah, let's listen to a voicemail that I think kind of ties into this. This is from Molly talking about what she thought a couple of the like more takeaways of this book were.
So I guess the takeaway for me was something along the lines of making sure that you're actually listening and asking what a person of color needs in an ally and not just doing whatever you think is best or what would make you feel morally superior in this situation. I felt like both Kelly and Alix were really guilty of not listening. Also, to make sure you stalk all your exes on social media so you aren't surprised if you live in the same city as them.
Pretty good takeaway.
Very good point.
Let's listen to another takeaway voicemail. This is Jen.
Hey, Nerdette. I think the moral of such a fun age is that no one is ever truly woke.
It's true. There was a lot of performative wokeness happening in this book.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of makes me think that, like, you just should never actually say you're woke, right?
You don't know what you are. You never know what you are, you know?
Yeah.
Question all your assumptions and question what you think you are, because you're probably wrong.
And it seemed that every attempt at wokeness in this book backfired spectacularly. Every time anybody set out with good intentions to be less that kind of white person, they ended up leaning into being that kind of white person. And it was it was very cringy to just
really
see people get it wrong at every turn.
Yeah. So can we go back to that last line just for a second? Because I think there's a lot in it that's really interesting. And it actually, the reason I started thinking about it was because someone named Karen on Instagram asked us if we thought the author was suggesting that, like Leeks learned about her true self from Amira, Briar might also have to do the same, which I think is not quite the case. One, because I don't think Leeks ever actually truly learned about herself. To me, it kind of got me thinking about like the idea of outsourcing things that you should know better about, you know? And I think that kind of speaks, Heather, too, to the idea of like, if you're refusing to learn, then of course you're going to have to pay somebody to do a lot of things for you. Yeah. But we actually got a really interesting voicemail from Ilana Massad, who is a writer in her own right. She actually reviewed Such a Fun Age for NPR, and she sent us a voicemail, and this is what she said about that last line.
To me, the last paragraph of the book is so heartbreaking because of what it says about the ways in which we teach classism and racism and assumptions about how power works in the world. Briar is an innocent for much of the book. And that last paragraph in which Amira grows older and begins to wonder about Briar getting older is one that betrays the fact that really no one is born with any kind of understanding of any of this, right? We are taught how to behave within our class, within our race. We're taught both by the people who mean us well and often by the people who mean us harm. And Briar is going to be raised by Leeks. And we know how Leeks is. So what does that say about how Briar is going to be?
I want Briar to grow up and rebel.
Well, I mean, there's a good chance of that.
Yeah, maybe.
There's a good chance of that. Because when you're, I mean, look, Leeks was a bad learner, or she would have learned from her parents' mistakes instead of becoming a little clone of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you grow up in a totally commodified, insane, you know, outsourced environment, a lot of people become, you know, activists, hippies, artists in that environment. You know?
That's
true. I mean, there's some statistic actually that, or at least this was true, like, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, that most artists come from either aristocratic ranks or the working class. There are not a lot of middle class.
Huh.
I like to think that Briar becomes, you know, some kind of...
Yeah. I love that.
I mean, she must be based on a real kid. She's so...
I know, she's really...
Real.
Excellent, yeah.
And she's so inquisitive. She seems to be a learner. She seems to prioritize.
But, like, she could unlearn that. You know, I mean, like, just because she's like that at three, if enough things don't go her way, she's not going to do that anymore, right?
Mm.
Let me also say that we're all actually in danger of becoming people who hire someone else to do things for us.
But
I'm not saying that mediocre Karens aren't particularly, you know, don't have enough immunity against that in particular. Yes, we have a little problem with it. But I also think that, I don't know, I just feel like our culture teaches us that path.
Oh,
and it's
for
never
sure.
taught us that path more vividly and vibrantly and held that in front of us than it does at this moment.
I honestly think this is one of those times where I'm doubling down on my, if I were president or whatever, how everyone in the world would be, you know, instead of like forced military service, you'd have to work in like a restaurant or a coffee shop or a retail location for like a year. And I think it would really help people's perspectives on class and the hierarchy of our society. This is a woman who's never really had to be on the other side of the service industry or of the hospitality industry or the childcare industry. So she doesn't know how it feels to be on the other side of that with somebody telling you what to do and making you wear a uniform or just leaving money on a counter and telling you to go off and have a good day. She doesn't know how it sounds coming out of her mouth to do all of those things.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for reading this book,
with me, you two. I appreciate it.
Should we just say that this book is fucking great?
It's right? Fucking great. How is this?
I loved it.
This first-time novelist wrote a better story about feminism and patriarchy than the goddamn Testament.
You know what? It really was just such a good ride. It kind of is like the...
Wasn't it? It's so plotty.
The Gone Girl of race.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah.
And class.
Yeah.
But so juicy and delicious. Just so vivid.
That. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we got to leave it at that, ladies. But thank you so much. This was such a pleasure. And I'm glad you actually liked the book. We'll call it a win.
Oh, my God.
Loved it.
What a relief.
All right, that's it for this month's book club. Next month, a new book, a new panel. We're going to do Uncanny Valley by Anna Wiener. I have not yet read it. It's a memoir about working in the tech industry. It looks pretty fucking cool. Find out the details when you sign up for our newsletter at wbez.org/nerdetteaf. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter or Instagram or at Nerdette Podcast. And we have a Goodreads book club group. You can find that if you just search for Nerdette Book Club. The show is produced by me, Greta Johnson, along with Justin Bull. Our executive producer is Brendan Banizak. Go read a book already.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.